This is your fault. You made this technology. You did not think about this. Or if you did, you did not create guardrails around these obvious problems. And now people are suffering as a result.
Hello and welcome to Tech Won't Save Us, made in partnership with The Nation magazine. I'm your host, Paris Marks, and before we get into this week's episode, I just wanted to talk about something pretty exciting with the podcast. This month, we celebrate our fourth birthday. It's hard to imagine saying that about a show that I started in the early days of the pandemic when we were all in lockdown, and I figured it was probably a better time than any to start a podcast. And now 4 years later, we're here. I've done over 200 episodes of the show, digging into a whole range of critical topics on the tech industry with such fantastic guests over those 4 years. We have more than 90 show transcripts on our website for people to explore, to go back over things, and just if they prefer to read rather than listen to these interviews. We've done live streams like our usual end of year live streams where we go over what happened in the past year in tech. And of course, the recent live stream that we did on Dune, and we want to start doing some more of those. I think you all have fun with our annual Worst Person in Tech contest that, of course, we'll be doing at the end of the year again this year. And in October of last year, we did an in-depth series called Elon Musk Unmasked, digging into who this man is, where he came from, and how he built this mythology of himself that is hopefully rapidly falling apart as he takes this turn to the extreme right. But that doesn't mean that there aren't really serious dangers that come with the power that he has amassed. Along with the many listeners who enjoy this show, who share it with their friends, media organizations have also recognized the work that Tech Won't Save Us is doing. Last year, the New York Times recommended Tech Won't Save Us for people wanting to know more about AI and said, quote, "For anyone alarmed by all of the widespread predictions about AI swallowing whole entire job sectors, the show's measured coverage might prove reassuring." Gizmodo said, quote, "Tech Won't Save Us weeds through the crap and snake oil of the industry and discusses the human consequences of the technology." And Mashable said, quote, "A healthy counterdose to the nauseating tech utopia idealism that usually surrounds Silicon Valley and enthusiast press coverage. People recognize what we're doing here with Tech Won't Save Us by spreading critical perspectives on technology and why it's so important. In the coming months, I'll be looking to explore even more issues that we haven't gone in depth on before, like Starlink, Neuralink, fast fashion, geoengineering, and previous waves of tech criticism. And that's all because of the support of listeners like you. Thank you to all of those who already support the show. And as we celebrate the show's fourth birthday, I'm asking those of you who don't already to consider going to patreon.com/techwontsaveus and supporting the show for as little as $5 a month so we can keep doing this work and to help us tackle a new project. If we get 200 new supporters this month, we're going to do a new series like the one we did with Elon Musk last year, but this time we'll be tackling the AI hype of the past year by digging into the false promises of tech titans like Sam Altman, the environmental consequences of these tools, including everything from the massive energy demands and water use, the growing backlash to hyperscale data centers built by companies like Microsoft, Amazon, and Google around the world, and we'll ask the key question, do we really need this much computation? With the AI hype in full swing and the growing drawbacks of the Silicon Valley model becoming all too apparent, it feels like the kind of series we need right now. And to help us make it, you can go to patreon.com/techwontsaveus and become a supporter this month to help us reach our goal. So thanks so much for your support. Now, let's turn to this week's episode. My guest is Kat Tenbarge. Kat is a tech and culture reporter at NBC News. Now, I'm sure that you've seen all of the stories circulating recently about the deepfake nude images and AI-generated explicit images that have been produced of celebrities, women celebrities in particular. Taylor Swift, of course, comes to mind, but many others. And the conversation that this is getting people to start having about one of the broader impacts of these generative AI tools that tech companies have been rolling out over the past year or so. In this episode, we dig deep on what is actually happening there, the problems with them, and we don't just focus on celebrities, even though those are the ones that really start these conversations and get people to pay attention to it. But this is actually having very serious effects for the non-celebrities, the regular people in the world as well. In particular, these tools are being used to generate explicit images of middle schoolers and high schoolers in the United States, but many other parts of the world, and having serious consequences for the victims of those things as those images circulate. I think it's positive that we're starting to have conversations about this and what we're going to try to do about it, but it seems like too little too late at this point when so many people have already been harmed. And so this is a conversation that I've been meaning to have for a while, and I'm very happy that Kat was willing to come on the show to dig into it with us and to give us such great insights into the serious problems that these generative AI tools are creating as they're allowing people to generate these explicit images of people in their lives and the serious consequences that come of that. One more thing to note, given the subject matter that we're discussing, we also get into some pretty heavy topics like suicide and self-harm. I know some people prefer to be aware of that ahead of time. So if you enjoy this conversation, make sure to help us hit our goal this month of getting 200 new supporters. And you can join people like Nina from Essex, Antonin from the Czech Republic, JK from Connecticut, Danielle from Victoria, BC, Fabian from Pau, Matthias from Switzerland, and Jim in Seattle by going to patreon.com/techwontsaveus, where you can support the show for as little as $5 a month and help us hit our goal to make that new series digging into the AI hype and the backlash to data centers. Thanks so much and enjoy this week's conversation. Kat, welcome to Tech Won't Save Us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. I've been really looking forward to speaking with you. I've been following your reporting and coverage for NBC News for a long time. And one of the topics that you have been writing about a lot recently, because it's obviously been in the public conversation, but it's also an issue that is of incredible importance. And I think even though it has become something that people are more aware of, I think it's an issue that is not getting the level of attention that it deserves because of the widespread harm that it's causing to a wide number of people and a growing number of people, and particularly women, but beyond that as well, right? And so I wanted to start with probably the moment or the event that many people will be most familiar with. And this is when in January, a number of explicit AI-generated images began spreading of Taylor Swift on X in particular, but then on some other platforms as well. Can you talk to us a bit about what happened there and what the significance of that kind of moment was?
Yes. So for, I would say, about the past year, roughly, I've been seeing more and more kind of incidents like this on X, as it's now called. And this was one of the biggest incidents probably in the entire deepfake space so far. And the virality of the moment really hinged on it being Taylor Swift, who was being victimized in these images. But to take a step back, like, what happened? Basically, there was an account that had a modest following, and the way that it had gained followers and gone viral was by posting sometimes things related to sports, sometimes things related to music, just pop culture tweets that were intended to go viral. And a lot of these accounts can go viral pretty easily by sexualizing women in the public eye. So sometimes they're able to do this in a more innocuous way just by like reposting an Instagram photo that's kind of sexy or, you know, commenting about various women's appearances. But in this case, what they did was they actually posted an image of Taylor Swift. It was an artificially generated image. So the entire image was fake. A lot of times when you see them, it's like a real photo that's stitched into something else, or it's like an edited photo that's edited with AI. But in this case, it almost looked more like a photorealistic drawing. And if you zoomed in, you could kind of tell like this isn't a real image. But what it depicted was someone who is very obviously Taylor Swift in a football stadium being, you know, sexually harassed, sexually assaulted even by various men in this football stadium. So it was this fantasy scene that played on a bunch of different elements. The biggest element was being non-consensual. Taylor Swift, obviously, not only did she not consent to this image being created or distributed, but the scene that's being depicted hinges on this idea of non-consensual sexual assault. And the other aspect here is that early this year, Taylor Swift was constantly in the news for being at her partner's football games because he's one of the biggest people in the NFL. And so it had become a cultural phenomenon already, this sort of sexist portrayal of Taylor Swift, like she's taking the attention away, or like, why is she there? Or like, why are women caring about football? And so this sort of like deepfake image capitalized on all of this. And I think that's why it really took off. And by the time it had been taken down, it had been viewed over 40 million times. So this reached the mainstream. It was showing up on almost everybody's timeline on X. And then the news started covering it and it just blew up from there.
I think you put that really well. And you know, when it comes to the way that these images spread around, like I think you would imagine that if something like this was going to happen, especially to someone like Taylor Swift, that it would be addressed very quickly, because someone like Taylor Swift is obviously not only in the public's eye very clearly, but also is quite an influential person. I'm sure that she can get in touch with, or her people can get in touch with, these social media companies to try to ensure that something is done. And it seemed quite notable in this event that it continued, you know, kind of spreading around for such a long period of time. What was going on there? And why did it seem like Twitter or X or whatever was not able to get a hold of this? And I believe in a story of yours that I read that these images also started to show up on platforms like Instagram and Facebook, and I'm sure elsewhere as well. How did it spread so much when something like this, these sorts of images should be taken down?
So this really confronts a lot of the issues in the space, is how the whole incident played out with the Taylor Swift images. And it exposed something that people who have been looking at deepfakes have been aware of for a while, which is that platforms are extremely reluctant to do anything about this. They're reluctant to actually take down the images. They're reluctant to suppress the images and links to the material. And above all, they're extremely reluctant to suspend the people who are posting this stuff and the companies that are posting this stuff. And so in the case of the Taylor Swift images, Twitter did not do anything. And I actually don't think Twitter ever did anything in regards to that viral image. What happened was fans of Taylor Swift started a campaign to mass report this image. And after hours and hours and hours of presumably hundreds, if not thousands, of Taylor Swift fans reporting the image, then it was finally taken down because they overwhelmed the reporting system. And that's how they got the image taken down. And it wasn't until like 24 hours after it was posted that you saw Twitter start to actually respond to this. And this really tracks with the average experience of someone who is victimized by material like this, including celebrities. I think we're going to go into this a little bit more later, but other less famous celebrities, but still people with PR teams, people with lawyers, other celebrities and influencers and creators have talked about how it shocked them that it was impossible to get this stuff taken down, and how they went through every avenue available to them and still nothing was being done about the problem. So the Taylor Swift situation really exposed to the mainstream not only what this problem looks like, but how difficult it is to get anyone to do anything about this problem.
Yeah, basically, if you have the Swifties on your side, maybe you can get some action because they can actually push these platforms to do something. But otherwise, if you don't have this kind of ravenous fan base, it might be difficult to actually get some action. And as you were saying there, you've been reporting for a while now on how this has been affecting a number of other people. But in particular, it seems to be young women kind of in their early 20s or their late teens, potentially even younger, kind of getting their images used and spread around in these ways by using these deepfakes and these kind of AI generated images. What are you seeing there? And, you know, as you were saying, what is their experience of this?
Yes. So the practice of deepfaking, it got on my radar in like the late 2010s, which is when you saw the technology evolve to this point. There were already sort of like rudimentary AI generated deepfakes coming out in like the years between 2016 and 2018. You saw on like the corners of Reddit, the corners of 4chan, like people were starting to do this. And visibly, the people who they were targeting were often celebrities. And it makes sense because if you're trying to go viral, or if you're trying not even to go viral, if you're just trying to get some attention for your technology or whatever you're doing with it, then it would make sense that you're going to go after a highly visible, high profile woman. Especially with the deepfake community, and you study how the community has evolved over the past like 7 years or so online, it's a highly gendered environment, and the ideology behind what they're doing is highly, highly gendered. So you see the communities of deepfake creators, they're just dominated by men. If there are women there, you're not really seeing them identify themselves as women. It's like a boys' club. It's like a men's space. And a lot of people who have studied sort of the deepfake space have talked about how it's emerged as a kind of social bonding community for a lot of men of various ages. And so in the early days, this was relatively contained to these male-dominated corners of the internet. But over the past few years, it got on my radar because I was seeing influencers who I covered having to deal with this, but not in a major, major way. So if I was already looking at a case where there was certain attacks against an influencer or an influencer had like a really controversial reputation, I would then sometimes see this material. Or if the influencer was extremely vulnerable. So like one of the first times I saw a deepfake was actually some child influencers. I saw some deepfakes of them on some extremely unsavory website. And my reaction, this was probably around 2019, I was like, this is horrible. But I have to be careful about how I approach this, because what I don't want to do is I don't want to make the problem inadvertently bigger by shining a spotlight on it. So at the time, it felt very underground and kind of like a new threat. And then in 2023, in actually January, so a year before the Taylor Swift images, something happened that registered to me as a really big deal, and it did become somewhat of a watershed moment, but most of the public, I doubt, is really aware of this. So what happened is a major streamer on the platform Twitch, he was live streaming. He was just live streaming one day. And in the corner of what he's showing on his camera, you can see his web browser. So you can see what he's doing on his computer. And he has a tab open. And the tab is he's looking at deepfakes of some of his peers and friends in the Twitch space on one of these really prolific deepfake websites. You can see what he's doing. I don't believe that he meant to showcase this. I don't think he meant to expose what he was doing. I think it was an accident, but it caused this cataclysmic outpouring of attention onto this issue. And the people who were paying attention were the people who actually wanted to consume this content. So from that day forward, we saw the numbers of traffic, the amount of traffic being directed to this website, it just started to skyrocket, and it has never stopped. Month over month, ever since this happened, the traffic has just continued to climb. And what happened by the end of the year is that in 2023, there were more deepfakes created than every other year combined thus far. So that is where the problem really emerged as a mainstream issue and not just something in the corners of the internet with the most unsavory types of people. And you also saw immediately the effect that this had on the women who he was looking at the deepfakes of, because some of those women who were some of the biggest female Twitch streamers were really, really understandably traumatized by this. They talked about all of the various consequences that this had on their mental health. One of the women who was affected talked about how she had struggled with an eating disorder in the past, and seeing her deepfakes, it had reignited some of those triggers, because she was seeing her face on a different woman's body, and it was starting to make her question her own body. Like, should my body look like the body in this deepfake that I'm seeing? And so that's just one of the many underexplored and sort of underrecognized consequences that this can have, in addition to all of the trauma of being essentially sexually abused. And I think a lot of people struggle to make that disconnect. Like, they're like, well, it's not real, it's not happening to you, it's fake, right? But in reality, our brains on a neurophysiological level do not recognize that. And this is something I've talked about with tech titans at companies like Adobe. We all recognize why this is an issue, because we all know that the way the brain works is that when you're processing videos and images, your brain is kind of treating it as if it's real. And so even if you know cognitively that what you're looking at is fake, it still has a real effect, not only on the person who's depicted, but on the viewer. And so it is a very similar issue in that sense to what used to be known as revenge pornography, which we now prefer not to use terms like revenge porn. We prefer to use terms like non-consensual sexually explicit material, because it's less stigmatizing. But the phenomenon, it has played out so similarly to how this issue played out in the 2010s with women's nude photos being posted online without their consent. It's really just like watching the same cycle play out yet again, because where we're at right now is women and victims of this are sharing how harmful it is. And tech companies and the people who are responsible for this problem, they have not caught up. And so now we're in a space currently where there's very little regulation, very little oversight, very little paths to recourse, but the problem is just growing and growing and growing.
It's shocking to hear you explain all of that, basically. I remember that story about the Twitch streamer. It was not something that I paid a lot of attention to, but I remember kind of when it was passing through the kind of media cycles that I follow in the tech industry. And again, like unlike the kind of Taylor Swift moment, it wasn't something that I saw kind of break out into the kind of broader public discourse, but was something that was contained to these sorts of communities that pay attention to the creators and what's happened on TikTok. And I'm sure the kind of communities that are paying attention to the deepfakes and AI generated explicit images and things like that. But I'm happy that you brought up the comparison to what was happening in the past, right? Because it's not nude images of celebrities in particular, or even kind of minor public figures, is something that is entirely new. These have circled around in the past, but usually they had to be real images and not things that were being created. As I was reading some of your stories and just kind of preparing for this, I thought back to the leaks from the Apple kind of cloud storage stuff that was particularly focused on Jennifer Lawrence, but I believe affected a number of other people about 10 years ago when their kind of nude images were circulating around. And I wonder what you see in the similarities to what happened then versus what is happening now, but also the differences in, I guess, what I would see as the scale of the problem, since these images can just be created with these tools that are now easily accessible by these tech companies, you know, in particular, since the boom of the generative AI tools being released in the past couple of years. What do you see in the difference between now and then, but also the similarities?
Yes, it's a great question. And it really illuminates the scale of the problem now, because in the 2010s, when you saw this issue arise, it happened in a lot of the same ways that we're seeing it now, where the highest profile incidents were like the iCloud hacks and the leaks. And, you know, fascinatingly enough and disturbingly enough, some of the same websites and some of the same people who posted that illicit material back in the 2010s, it's the same people posting the deepfakes now. It's the same websites posting the deepfakes now, because we never really got a handle on how to stop that from happening. We created, you know, tech companies eventually, after years of women suffering, created pathways for them to be able to at least take this material down from Google, from Facebook, from whatever. But the websites that existed as sort of like the black market of this practice, those websites were never taken down. They're not mainstream tech platforms, so they're not going to get yanked in front of Congress. People don't know them. They're not recognizable. They are less susceptible to scrutiny and media pushback and regulation. And so those websites and those people, they're still out there. They still exist. And this has become the new goldmine for them. As you alluded to, I think that one of the major problems here is, you know, we still have the non-consensual sharing and distribution of intimate images. It's still a massive problem. And even when, for example, it became more commonly known that, like, you don't want to just send your nude images to anyone because they could post them on the internet. Even when that became like kind of common knowledge, of course, abusive partners and vengeful ex-partners would still release this material after they broke up. But in addition to that, predators have always gone out of their way to acquire this material through whatever means necessary. So back in the 2010s, when it was called revenge porn and that was like the big deal, I remember one of the guys who actually did go to prison. The reason that they were able to convict him is because he had hired a hacker to hack into women's devices to find this kind of material. Because that guy, his name is Hunter Moore, he was making money off of this, as a lot of people were able to. He was profiting and he was able to monetize the spread of this non-consensual material on the internet. So once it became profitable to do this in addition to something that people just wanted to do maliciously, that's when it really became a kind of unstoppable force that eventually institutions had to pay attention to. And eventually, I think, like with the celebrity iCloud leaks, it reached a point where it could no longer be ignored, because you can ignore thousands of anonymous women. You cannot ignore Jennifer Lawrence. She has access to the New York Times. She can say, hey, this is a sex crime. And so then you start to see things happening. And it's the same thing with Taylor Swift. In terms of what is different now and what is so staggeringly horrifying about the deepfake issue, it's exactly what you said, Paris. Before, it had to be some sort of real material. And, you know, you could use hidden webcams in changing rooms. You could go to great lengths to acquire real explicit material of victims. But now you don't need to do any of that. And I'm about to list a couple of real things that people are doing to create deepfakes. There are people who are going on to public live stream footage of courtrooms and pulling images from people testifying at the stand and turning them into deepfakes. There are people going through women's Instagram accounts and OnlyFans profiles and taking clothed pictures of them and running them through programs that will undress them. There are people doing this with girls' yearbook photos and pictures of women and girls taken at school. There are people doing this with broadcast news interviews, as well as movies and TV and podcasts and social media posts and all the other ways in which we are able to share our images today. And that doesn't even get into what created those Taylor Swift images, because there was never even any real picture. They just were able to create it out of thin air. So the problem now is that the scale of being able to perpetrate what should be considered a crime, the scale is now unimaginable. And you see this with individual perpetrators, with the amount of damage that they're able to cause. So I've seen cases where an individual perpetrator has been able to create deepfakes of women who are close to him. Like maybe he creates deepfakes of a dozen of his female classmates. And then additionally, he's running all these celebrity and influencer women through the same technology. And so now he's able to victimize an entire scale of women, those who he knows personally to him and those who he doesn't know. And that is a kind of like a level of criminology, I think, like a level of criminal potential that is somewhat modern. And the scale, I think, is something that people have yet to fully realize just how much of a deal this is.
It's shocking when you actually start to kind of grapple with the broader impacts of it. And I want to ask about how it's affecting people beyond the celebrities, but I have one more question before I do that. And you mentioned how this can be sort of like a bonding thing. Like there are these communities where men make these images of women and share them with one another. And those are groups that exist online. But I also wanted to know a bit about how the economy of this actually works, because as you said, there's also a lot of websites that profit off of this and that have been doing so for a long time. Obviously, we know there are plenty of tools that are created to make these sorts of images. How did these companies make their money? And how does this become such a big problem that so many different actors can make money off of, even as so many people are suffering as a result of it?
Yes. So with the internet, there are so many possible ways to monetize things now, and there are so many ways that you can set up monetization schemes, both with, you know, sort of mainstream financial institutions and outside of them. So one way that I've seen people monetize the creation of deepfakes is there will be a website that is kind of like a YouTube clone, and it functions the same way that a lot of free porn websites do, like Pornhub, where you go on at this current stage of our regulatory environment, depending on what state you're in, you may or may not need to provide your ID to view what's on that website, on Pornhub specifically, but typically, you can just access it from your browser. You can just go to the website and you can just watch free videos. And that's how most people consume porn today, is for free. If you're looking to make money off of your videos, there are deepfake websites that are basically like YouTube or Pornhub clones. And you can go and you can watch like a couple minutes of a deepfake video for free. And then in the description, it'll be like, here are various ways where you can unlock longer content, customized content, And most disturbingly, content that features individuals who you personally know. And so there has to be a way to actually get money into the hands of the people who are making this stuff. And the ways that I've seen them do that is they can use cryptocurrency. So cryptocurrency wallets have become a big part of this economy. And that is a very difficult kind of thing to figure out, like, how are we going to stop this? Because of the nature of cryptocurrency, it's harder to trace, it's harder to control. There's no government that is going to determine like the use of certain types of cryptocurrency. So that's one way that they can profit off of it, is through crypto. Another way, staggeringly, is that, you know, an NBC investigation, we found a website that was like an OnlyFans clone, and they had MasterCard and Visa hooked up to this website where they were selling deepfakes. And we reached out to MasterCard and Visa and we were like, hey, why are you offering your payment processor services for this website? And we never got a response. And it's unclear whether it was because of our reporting or not, but that one site that we found basically just banned everyone. Like, that site ended up going down, but there is the potential to just create a new one. And I think that a lot of these financial institutions and payment processors, they have become really strict about supposedly pornographic content over the past several years. But the deepfake stuff is getting through. And so it raises a question, who's at the wheel? Who's monitoring, like, who's allowed to use Visa and MasterCard? And are they doing a good enough job? Because at this current stage, deepfake producers are able to market and make money off of this content using people's credit cards.
That's a really good point about how, you know, kind of determined they've been to crack down on, you know, the ability to sell kind of nude images and stuff like that, just to any kind of sex work or anything like that. And the target that has been placed on that by lawmakers and by payment processors and whatnot, but how these deepfake companies and whatnot are seemingly able to get away with that, at least so far. And I imagine part of that is because it can kind of be like a bit of a whack-a-mole situation with new ones kind of propping up here and there. But as you were saying, this is not just something that affects, you know, the celebrities that we all see on the news all the time. It's average everyday people who are also being affected by this and who are having these images circulating about them. As we were talking about before we started recording, there was a documentary that I don't know if it's fully released right now, if it's still showing at festivals, but that is really kind of grappling with this issue called Another Body. And it looks at, you know, this woman, I believe she's a high schooler in the video, and they actually kind of creatively use deepfakes in order to hide who she actually is by using a deepfake for her kind of throughout the whole film. And you don't find out until the end, if I remember correctly, or maybe it's partway through. But that is kind of a film that really showed me how much of a problem that this is. What is the widespread implications of this? And what are we seeing when it comes to regular women, to even girls in like high school and things like that, when, you know, the people they know are making these images of them?
So Another Body, just a fantastic documentary. And it opened my eyes to the scale of this problem as well. And I think part of the recent evolution of deepfakes, what we're dealing with at this very moment, is that even in 2018, 2019, 2020, in those years, the technology existed and people were using it for this purpose, but it was sophisticated. There was kind of an entry level that you have to be able to access to create a deepfake. You have to have a computer that can store all of this technology on it and process all of this at once. And you have to have the technical ability to know how to do this. And so for years, that limited the spread and the scale of the destruction. In the Another Body documentary, the perpetrator who they identify, he's a comp sci student in college. So he understands computer science, so he's able to understand how to do this. What we're dealing with today is that there are hundreds of apps on the Google Play Store and on the App Store right now that you can download, and you can input photos. And some of them are really rudimentary, because I've tested out several of them on pictures of myself to try to figure out, like, what can you really do with these apps? And it varies. Some of them don't do it very well. Some of them are like super, super rudimentary. But there are enough, and some of them you have to pay them $5 or you have to sign up for a subscription. And a lot of them are scammers. So I try not to do that because I don't want someone to have my credit card info.
And in that case, I guess Google and Apple are also getting their cut as people are doing this.
Exactly. And so with all of these apps, you no longer need to have any sophistication at all. Because I'm someone who doesn't have a lot of comp sci sophistication. I'm at a really rudimentary level. And so when I'm testing this stuff out, I'm coming at it from the sensibilities that your average fifth grader would have and their abilities to navigate these types of apps. And that's exactly why we're seeing this problem in middle schools. Because now what's happening is these apps, they're being advertised on mainstream social media platforms. They're being advertised to young people. They're being advertised with photos of young celebrities that fall into these people's age groups. And the message that's being sent to high schoolers and middle schoolers around the world is just download this app and do this and it'll take 5 seconds. And that is exactly what is happening. We've seen cases at least a dozen in middle high schools. And I truly believe that that is just the tip of the iceberg, because what we've seen in some of these cases is that the schools kind of try to cover it up more than they try to actually fix the problem, because what middle or high school wants to be on the national news for a deepfake incident? But regardless, the problem, it's woven its way into all of these various communities around the world. There was a middle school in Spain where this happened. I think there was a school I saw in Canada where this happened. When you look at the map of where this technology and the creators behind these deepfakes are coming from, it's all over the world. I've spoken to victims from India. I've spoken to victims from Australia. I've seen technology developed in China, in the Ukraine. I've seen technology and victims. It's very clearly a global issue. It hinders the ability for change, because even if, let's say, we banned deepfake apps in the United States, which we're nowhere near doing, so many of these apps are produced outside of the United States. And how do you even trace down the perpetrator? You know, really frustratingly, a lot of times when someone is a victim of something like this and they go to their local police department, the local police officer who they interface with, more likely than not, does not have any specialized training or knowledge to deal with this issue. And unfortunately, what a lot of victims hear, and this tracks with how police respond to sexual violence in all situations, a lot of times what they're hearing is, we don't think this is a crime. We can't help you. And even if we do think this is a crime, we're not going to devote any resources to helping you figure out who's making these deepfakes of you. So it's left to the victims, in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, to try to seek some sort of recourse themselves.
As you describe that, I can only think about the harm that comes of it as well. Like, I'm the furthest thing from an expert on this issue, but I know that I have read multiple stories of people who are in high school and have had just nude images that they took of themselves or that someone took of them kind of spread around through their school. And then, you know, I know that these are really sensitive topics, but engaged in self-harm or even attempted suicide or committed suicide as a result of that. And now if these sorts of images can just be created by anybody, by any of their students, and spread around throughout their schools, and they have so little control about that, like, are we seeing broader impacts on these students and these victims of the creation of these images?
Yes. There has been at least one reported case, I believe, in the UK of a young person who died by suicide after seeing deepfakes. And I don't have this reporting myself. We didn't shore it up ourselves. But from what I saw reported in like some tabloids, this child made reference to this issue as why they were resorting to this. So absolutely, we're seeing these types of consequences spiral out. And I think we're going to be seeing and hearing a lot more. And in addition to that, one of the things that really alarms me about what's happening here is the perception of fear and the ways that now women and girls are trying to protect themselves and the ways they're being encouraged to protect themselves. The fact is, there is nothing that you as an individual can do to prevent someone from doing this to you. But people are going to try. They're going to try to find a way to avoid this happening to them. And what that looks like is women unenrolling from male-dominated fields because of their male classmates doing this to them. That's what we saw with the Another Body documentary. Is like, it was a computer science course, which is already a very male-dominated field, and they're doing it to all the women in their classes. So the end result could therefore be you see this gender discrimination continue to be perpetuated in these male-dominated fields. And I think that honestly has a lot more to do with it than people realize, because that's the story of a lot of tech, unfortunately. A lot of tech comes back to this issue where you don't have women in the room, you don't have women in leadership positions, and sexual harm and non-consensual imagery becomes a key functionality of the tech that we produce. So that's one huge issue with this. But in addition to that, you also see women and girls wanting to recuse themselves from public life out of fear that this will happen to them. And I've seen people, even people who seemingly have good intentions, say things like, this is why you shouldn't put your face on the internet. And it's like, guys, you're doing the work for them. Because let's be real, the only way to be a public figure in 2024 is to have some sort of online presence. So you're basically telling women and girls en masse, don't try to be a public figure. Don't try to go into politics. Don't try to be a visible person in your field or in the world in general out of fear that your image will be corrupted or that your image will be abused. And so I think that's a really harmful message that is now being perpetuated because of this. And the saddest thing about it is that wouldn't even work. When we see these cases pop up in middle and high schools, it's not because the girls have social media presences, it's because it's their classmates doing this to them. And it really tracks with the entire spectrum of gender-based violence and how we see it most commonly perpetrated, which is by people who are close, physically close to the victim.
Yeah, I think it's such an important observation for you to make. And I'm not surprised to hear those sorts of things, but to think that these are the effects that women are experiencing as a result of these technologies, and there's so little accountability for the people creating these technologies, let alone the people using them in order to create these images, it just makes you profoundly angry.
Yes. Yes. And it makes you, I know that after looking at this for the past year, and I know there are other reporters like Samantha Cole, who has been reporting on this from day one, from like the day of the first deepfake, you get this sense over time, you start to realize that this giant pressing issue does not matter to the major companies and the major people who are rushing ahead in this AI arms race. Like, they're acting like this doesn't even exist and that it's not even happening, because if people were to really wrestle with the actual harm that is currently being committed by this technology, then we would start to ask, hey, should Microsoft be producing this stuff at this rapid rate with zero guardrails? Should OpenAI really have the prominence that it currently does in business and culture? Shouldn't we be asking these tech CEOs these kinds of questions? They don't want that to happen. They love how much money they're making from AI right now. They don't want to have to deal with this conversation. They would prefer that nobody talked about it. And when they do talk about it, they constantly talk about it as if it's this thing that's going to happen in the future and not something that is currently already happening now.
It just makes you so angry. Like, I remember reading one of the stories that you wrote. I believe it was after the Taylor Swift incident, where the Microsoft CEO was asked about this stuff. And he was like, yeah, we definitely need, you know, kind of rules around this or whatnot. You know, we need to be paying more attention to it. But it's like, that is not nearly enough. Like, that doesn't get to the scale of what is happening and how, in many cases, it's the tools that are created by these major companies that are helping to enable these things to actually be done.
Yes, that has been one of the most shocking, and it shouldn't be shocking, but it's been one of the most staggering findings for me personally. Like, that's such a good case study, the Taylor Swift Microsoft response, because as he was, you know, doing that interview, 404 Media was figuring out that the Taylor Swift images were created with Microsoft's generative AI tools. And I remember Microsoft tried to say, like, we don't think that's true, we don't think it was our tools. But eventually they relented and they were like, yeah, it was our tools. And now we've strengthened these protections. But we cannot function in a society where we're going to let the harm happen first and then we're going to respond to it. We simply cannot. And that's what these tech companies have gotten away with for so long. And that's their status quo, is they're just going to create new technology and they're going to push it out and they're just going to wait for people to abuse it. And then they'll have the conversation. If that's the process, if it's not, let's consider the harmful effects before we push it out, then people will lose their lives. They already are. And I feel as though they exist in this echo chamber of plausible deniability. And at some point we have to puncture that and be like, no, this is your fault. You made this technology. You did not think about this. Or if you did, you did not create guardrails around these obvious problems. And now people are suffering as a result.
Definitely. You know, it's not just the people creating these images that are at fault here and need to be held to account, though they absolutely do. You know, it's the people who are enabling it in the first place, who are creating these technologies, who are not thinking about the broader consequences or just ignoring the fact that there will be broader consequences because that is much more beneficial and easier for them to be able to roll out all this stuff and create all the hype around it and get the investors excited rather than saying, oh, there are a lot of potential problems here that we actually need to address. Can you talk a bit about, you mentioned Microsoft there, but obviously OpenAI has these tools, Google has these tools, I believe Facebook or Meta is working on their own. Do we see similar things from a lot of these major companies when it comes to people being able to use them to create images like this?
Yes. And I think that part of what makes this complicated is that a lot of this technology is open source, and a lot of it is then able to be taken from, you know, like the code repository, like GitHub, for example, which is owned by Microsoft. Like Microsoft owns GitHub. And if you go to GitHub right now, you will see hundreds, if not thousands, of AI models that are on there for anyone to use, that are created just for this purpose. They're not even under the pretense of being created for other purposes. There are just like bounty networks popping up everywhere. Like, please someone AI this woman, or please someone make an AI tool that can do this to women. It's just right out happening in the open. And in addition to that, one of like the really fundamental issues that I have with the current AI space is that they're putting these products out into the consumer market, and they're not even creating technology. There is no technology that can reliably detect if something is AI generated. And in a lot of cases, like OpenAI is a good example of this. When they first launched ChatGPT, they were like, here's a side program where you can put the text into it and we'll tell you if it came from ChatGPT. That didn't work. They pulled that program like a year later and they were like, this doesn't work. The accuracy rate is so low. So now there's just nothing. And they're very transparent about that. Like they write on their website, like there's nothing that exists to reliably detect AI generated text. There's nothing that exists to reliably detect AI generated video. So they're throwing the rest of us to the wolves. And I think that people like need to have some solidarity, but I understand why people don't, because this is all moving so quickly that I don't think people realize like the sheer impact and magnitude of everything. But it's like these companies do not exist in our interest. When they talk about strategies to combat the harms of AI, they're not talking about you and me. They're only talking about themselves. And the sooner that everybody wakes up to that, I'm just like, AI is not even for us. It's not for us. It's to take our jobs away. It's to make our creative work less valuable. It's to make us more productive for their bottom line. And very little of what AI is projected to do will impact the average person in a meaningful way. It's all about creating, inflating these artificial stock prices and values for the people at the top to benefit the most.
It's so well said. And, you know, reading your work, I was struck how the lack of responsibility isn't just in the creation of these tools and what people can use them for, but also just in the search engines and the way that many people access information, right? If you go onto a Google search engine, you know, just the other day, I was, for example, trying to look up images of like Elon Musk and Mars for like a piece I was writing. And so many of, you know, the images that like Google served me up were AI generated stuff. And obviously it wasn't labeled as that, but it reminds me in the past when the image results used to be filled with like Pinterest images, and now it's just like stuffed with AI generated garbage. And if you can't clearly tell, in many cases, you would think that they're just normal images or something that someone had created. But reading your reporting, this is also a serious problem with explicit images, where these deepfakes show up in Google images. Even when you search for the names of certain celebrities, for example, it will show up in their kind of results. Like, what are we seeing on the search engine side of things? And are these companies even properly responding to that?
Yes. So the search engine component is huge, because a lot of the ways that people get exposed to this material, whether they want to or not, is through the search engines. When you look at those major deepfake websites that are hosting the majority of this material, the way that people are getting to that website is they're Googling so-and-so deepfakes, and then Google is giving them the links to go to this website. This is a Google problem. Yes, the website is ultimately at fault for hosting this material, but Google has a lot of responsibility for powering the existence of this website. People wouldn't be going to this website if Google wasn't sending them there. And Google, the stance that it takes is like, we're going to wait and see how the cultural conversation, and specifically the legal conversation around this, develops. Like, they're basically like, we're going to wait and see if this becomes illegal, and then we'll react. Like, our policies are shaped by local legal requirements. And so they'll just tell you, like, they're not looking at this from a moral perspective. They're not listening to the people who use their platform. What they're listening to is the only thing that has the power to keep them accountable. And that system of accountability is not doing enough to combat this issue. So Google has removed itself from having responsibility. The only way that it's going to take responsibility is if people demand Google takes responsibility for this. And something that is so insidious about the way that this happens is, like, Google, in its own defense, will say, we're not showing you deepfakes. We're not even showing you sexually explicit material. If you just type in the words Jennifer Lawrence, you have to type in Jennifer Lawrence deepfakes to get there. And that's half true, because what some researchers found is that if you are a news consumer who wants to hear about Jennifer Lawrence's thoughts on deepfakes, or if you want to hear about Jenna Ortega's thoughts on deepfakes, or Scarlett Johansson, what has she said about deepfakes? Because Scarlett Johansson is one of the most victimized women in the deepfake space. And so Scarlett Johansson has been talking about this for a long time. And so when you go to try to find an article about Scarlett Johansson's thoughts on deepfakes, Google's not just giving you that in the results. Google is giving you links to deepfakes when you're explicitly looking for things that aren't that. And so Google's defense is like, we only give people what they're looking for, but that's not true. And even if it was true, I think we really have to ask Google, is that right? Should we give people this type of material that's harmful just because they want to see it? That's one of the biggest questions, I think, in the regulatory space, is like, does Google have a responsibility to actually prevent people from accessing material that's harmful? And in other cases, the answer is yes. When it comes to things like child sexual abuse material, Google isn't just going to give you that because you want to see it. But with deepfakes, they haven't quite reached that point yet, and they need to be pushed into that point.
Yeah. And I guess with the child sexual abuse material, that's because that is explicitly illegal. And so they have to act on it, right?
Yes. And even then, and this is something I did an article about, even with child sexual abuse material, which I talked to a bunch of legal experts, and I went back to the statutes that were created in the late 90s around what constitutes child sexual abuse material. Even back then in the 90s, they were already kind of thinking about what we're dealing with right now, because they wrote into those statutes in the US code that computer-generated child pornography is illegal. So they already had this kind of protection set up, because AI, it's new in some senses, but it is not new in other senses. People have been talking about artificial intelligence since like the 1970s. And computer generation, hello, the Shrek movie was computer generated. So it's been something that has existed for a long time. And what I found by just searching like pretty general terms related to deepfakes, I found deepfake examples in the top Bing and Google search results. And what they were was they were pictures of celebrities taken before the age of 18. The one in my article that I really focused on is like this picture of Miley Cyrus. And the picture of Miley Cyrus, at the oldest, she was 15 in the photo. And they had taken her face and they had pasted it over adult nude bodies. And this was coming up in the top search results for like Miley Cyrus deepfakes. So that image should not be there. That is technically not allowed. And when I show that to Google, they take it down because they're like, yeah, we recognize that that's not right. That's prohibited. But it just goes to show that even though this is prohibited, they're not necessarily going to catch it. And I think that's like another part of this is they have to actually efficiently be able to detect and remove this material. And when it comes to deepfakes, we're not seeing that, not even with deepfakes that depict children.
Yeah. Once again, like I'm shocked and not shocked at what you're saying. And it really strikes me that when you talk about responsibility and you think about how little Google is doing on this and so many of these tech companies are doing on this. Meanwhile, we saw just a few weeks ago, there was this rapid backlash to their Gemini AI tool because it dared to show some racial diversity in historical events when it was prompted. And something like that, it seemed like it immediately had a response and immediately had something to say, and the CEO had something to say about it. But when we see these issues with deepfakes or when we see other issues that have come of their AI tools, they're much less likely to actually say something or actually take some degree of action. Like, what do you make of the difference in the way that they respond to these different issues?
That's a really good question. And I think that a lot of it depends on who is like raising these complaints. With like the Gemini stuff, you were seeing not only like giant conservative voices speak out about this, but there's this like alliance currently in the big tech space between certain venture capitalists and certain billionaires and certain tech platform owners have become very close and very friendly with these extremely conservative voices. And so when you see someone like Elon Musk or Bill Ackman start to speak out on an issue, well, they're in the same room as the people who run Google. So now it's your colleagues who are calling this out. And I truly think that like if someone like Elon were going to make a big deal out of the question of deepfakes, maybe we would see a response. But Elon can't do that because his own platform is part of the problem. And I don't think Elon is interested in women's rights, more broadly speaking.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. We've been talking quite a bit about the responsibility of the companies and the responses that they have had to this and, you know, how those responses have been truly ineffective and not nearly meeting the bar that I think most people would expect of them. But on the kind of legal side of things, when we look at lawmakers on the federal level in the United States, but also on the state level, and I don't know if you have any insight about internationally, what are we seeing, you know, from our politicians when it comes to trying to address this issue? And does it seem like there are any attempts that would actually make some real difference here?
There have been some positive strides, both internationally and within the United States. Australia was one of the first countries to actually form like a task force dedicated to this issue. Europe in general has way better and tighter regulations around this type of stuff, although not necessarily with deepfakes. Europe has better protections around things like data privacy. And because of the way they've legislated online issues in the past, they have a clearer pathway to legislating something like deepfakes. In the United States, federally speaking, when it comes to regulating the internet, we're a mess. Like, we have very poor regulations, and the process to actually getting anything passed federally is super convoluted and messy and difficult to do. On the state level, it's much easier to pass things like this. And so we've seen legislation here and there. We've seen a bunch of states and more with every passing week, introducing legislation, passing legislation, getting things on the books related to deepfakes. The problem is then that, like, for example, California has some decent laws around this issue. But then there are high profile victims like celebrities and influencers based in California. The problem then becomes identifying and having jurisdiction over the perpetrators. And the problem also becomes who bears the legal responsibility here? Because the act of deepfaking somebody into a nude image may be illegal, but in the act of carrying out that law, the enforcement of that law, that's where you begin to run into a lot of questions and technicalities. And a lot of times, unfortunately, for victims, there's so much involved in the process of trying to get justice. And this is something that applies to victims of all kinds of crimes. And it's an issue that is very frequently overlooked, which is that you have to have resources. You have to be able to afford and access a lawyer. You have to have the time and the money to dedicate to fighting your case. These are things that are not available to the vast majority of victims. And so we're not going to see the vast majority of victims, even under these laws, get that kind of justice. And so, you know, approaching the issue of deepfakes then takes on a much more multifaceted sort of approach, because we also have to look at social factors. We have to disincentivize what these young boys are doing in these middle schools and high schools. We have to sort of make it clear that this type of behavior isn't going to be tolerated on various levels. And again, we've seen strides there. We've seen some good things happen, I would say. We've seen some recent middle schools really crack down on this in a way where they're removing perpetrators out of the school system. They're separating perpetrators from victims. They're showing victims that you matter and that this is a problem and that it was wrong. And even something that simple can make a huge difference in actually combating this issue on a cultural level.
Speaking of the cultural level, do we see a shift on that as well? Because I remember kind of in the past when people would talk about kind of nude images circulating, it was a very sort of shameful thing. And, you know, it could have kind of severe consequences for people, especially people in the public eye. You know, my question is not to kind of dismiss how important this is and dismiss the need for action on this. But do we also see a change kind of in the social norms where it's like, if this happens to you, you know, you shouldn't feel shamed, or, you know, people aren't going to think worse of you. Do you see changes there?
I see a lot of different things happening at once. And so it really depends case to case, looking at the various influences within the community of the person who's being affected. So in some ways, we've seen like some progress. So a case that I reported on a couple weeks ago involved a middle school in Beverly Hills. And what I saw in that case was some really progressive kind of action that I don't always see. But I think part of why I was seeing that is because Beverly Hills is a community that is unlike most other communities. It's an extremely wealthy, high-profile community that is kind of incomparable to most communities in the United States and globally. And so with those vast resources and that vast spotlight, they did what seemed to be the right thing. Elsewhere, you're not always going to get people reacting in the same way. And I think culturally, for example, not just in the United States, but also in other countries, in conservative communities, you might have an approach to this issue that blames the victim. And we've seen that. We've seen, especially in the early days of deepfakes, women who were targeted in really culturally conservative areas faced a lot of backlash from their communities, and they were blamed in a lot of cases, and they faced violence as a result of being violated. So something that concerns me outside of the deepfake issue, but that intersects with it, is we have this really radical anti-feminism ideology that is growing in lots of different areas. We see it with young boys and young men in various communities around the world. They're influenced by people like Andrew Tate and people who are telling them, actually, you should do stuff like this. You should assert your power and your dominance as men by violating sexually the women and girls around you. So when you have boys getting that message, that's going to influence how these sorts of incidents play out. And I think right now we're seeing kind of like a growing gap where some communities are becoming more progressive and some people are becoming more and more progressive, but you also have people becoming more and more regressive. So I think that for some victims, there will be cultural things that help them. Like, I think that you're still seeing the Me Too movement sort of reverberate and make women more confident in coming forward about being the victim of sexual crime. But you're also seeing a backlash to the Me Too movement that is then trying to make women not do that. So we have all of these competing cultural influences that are going to shift the environment for anyone who's a victim of this.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And unfortunately, those kind of Andrew Tate ideas and the people like him who promote this are far more influential than they should be. And as you say, even if norms are changing to a certain degree, there's still that kind of visceral reaction of seeing these images of yourself and how, as you were talking about earlier, this can lead to people wanting to kind of, you know, move out of public life and try to avoid, you know, situations or careers or sectors where they might face a higher risk of having these images being made of them and being put in these situations. And that is completely unacceptable. And so I think my final question would be, what do you see in the activism around this? You know, we talked about before we started recording the My Image, My Choice, you know, movement that's been put together by the people who created the Another Body documentary. Obviously, I think that this issue is becoming something that more people are aware of and that, you know, lawmakers are feeling more pressure to do something about. What do you see on that angle? And where do you see this issue kind of going over the next year or so?
So, like you just said, I have seen some really heartening activism work and advocacy work popping up in this space. A lot of people who have been committed to this issue for a long time, because before deepfakes reached this point, they were working with these same issues in response to the revenge porn crisis of the 2010s. And the same people who dealt with a lot of concepts like intimate privacy, which is sort of a modern concept in itself, but people who have been leading the charge on that issue are also responding to this issue. And so you see advocacy organizations, as well as the organizations that exist for survivors of all types of gender-based and sexual violence. Something that you end up seeing happen a lot as you're looking at how this plays out is people who were already abusive, they just expand their toolkit. So something like deepfakes just becomes a new tool in the abusive toolkit that a lot of individuals weaponize against their victims. So like helplines and resources for victims of all these types of crimes, they're seeing this happen more and more in cases, in the same way that they saw a loss of intimate privacy in regards to real images begin to impact their clients 10 years ago. They're now seeing these fake images and like fake things impact their clients as well. So we're seeing a lot of response on a lot of different fronts that I think is really important. And in terms of how this issue is going to develop over the next couple of years, I think we're just starting to hit that stride. I think we're going to see so much more movement come out of this. Because a lot of times when you look at the field of victims' rights, it takes people time to process what has happened to them before they're in a place where they can do something about it. So I think that a lot of people who are tragically being victimized right now and over the past couple of years, in the coming years, they're going to reach a place where they're like, I have now processed what I went through and I want to do something about it. And so we're going to start hearing these voices and these testimonies, and they're going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think that bringing it back to what we talked about at the very beginning, after the Taylor Swift deepfake incident, I personally saw more legislative and more just like action and attention and interest and support happening than I had seen at any other previous point. It was like a wave, a tidal wave of just attention being paid to this issue. And so having celebrities be involved in this, their advocacy can be important. In the same way that Jennifer Lawrence saying what happened to me was a sex crime and anyone who viewed those pictures is a sexual offender, when she said that, that reverberated. That said to so many women, like, I'm not alone. Like, Jennifer Lawrence is speaking for me. And it said to people, like, you should reconsider what you consider to be okay. And I think that we're going to see those norms shift, and it's going to take place with a lot of big conversations as well as a lot of smaller conversations.
Yeah, and that's so important. And it's something that absolutely needs to happen. And this accountability needs to start being something that we see a lot more of, both on the level of the people who make these images, but as we were talking about, the companies that are making the tools that allow them to do it in the first place as well. Kat, this is such an important issue, and you've given us so much insight into understanding the broader ramifications of it. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me and for giving a platform to this issue.
Kat Tembarge is a tech and culture reporter at NBC News. Tech Won't Save Us is made in partnership with The Nation magazine and is hosted by me, Paris Marks. Production is by Eric Wickham and transcripts are by Bridget Palou Fry. Tech Won't Save Us relies on the support of listeners like you to keep providing critical perspectives on the tech industry. You can join hundreds of other supporters by going to patreon.com/techwontsaveus and making a pledge of your own. Thanks for listening, and make sure to come back next week.